From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, America's premier medical research agency, this is Pinpoint on Women's Health with Dr. Vivian Pinn, Director of the Office of Research on Women's Health. Now, here's Dr. Pinn.
Welcome to another episode of Pinpoint on Women's Health. Each month, in this podcast, we take a look at some of the latest developments in the area of women's health and the medical research that affects our lives and our health. For this podcast, I'm very happy to welcome Dr. Peter Schmidt, who is Chief of the Section on Behavioral Endocrinology in the National Institute of Mental Health here at the National Institutes of Health. But first, some hot flashes from the world of women's health research. Coming up in 60 seconds when we continue with Pinpoint on Women's Health.
Truth. Jackie is a 48-year-old mother of two. Truth. Jackie had a heart attack. Truth. Heart disease is the number one killer of women. Consequence. Jackie's life will never be the same. Heart disease can lead to heart attack, disability, and death. Find out your risk and take action today to lower it. Learn the heart truth. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, National Institutes of Health, National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute.
Attention swimmers, get out of the water. Everybody, out of the water immediately.
Dude, is that... It's a pair of thunder thighs. Big ones, too. That mom who's been swimming a lot with her kids must have lost them.
Whoa. I heard about this happening once up at Laguna.
Small step number 54. Play with your kids. It's just one of the many small steps you can take to get healthy. Learn more at www.smallstep.gov.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Pinpoint on Women's Health. Again, we want to take a look at some of the hot flashes in the news regarding women's health research. There's been a recent publication reporting on a study coming out of Duke University, the Duke Comprehensive Cancer Center, and the Duke Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy that have reported that there appear to be different genomic characteristics to breast cancers in women under the age of 45 that differ from breast cancers that are seen in older women, especially those over the age of 65. Until we know more about this, perhaps it may not mean so much to each individual woman, but the significance of this is when we know that there often tend to be more aggressive tumors in younger women with breast cancer that also tend to be less responsive to treatment, this type of characterization can help us develop better treatments and better ways to understand these tumors in women who are in the younger age range. Another study that was published recently was from the Swedish Medical Center and the University of Washington School of Public Health and Community Medicine in Seattle, Washington, having to do with how to cut risks for preeclampsia in women who are pregnant. This study reported that eating more fiber during the first trimester of pregnancy seems to reduce the risk of developing preeclampsia, which is a potentially fatal condition characterized by elevated blood pressure. According to the Preeclampsia Foundation, about 5 to 8% of women may experience this condition during pregnancy, and it's characterized by elevated blood pressure in women. And the only way to end preeclampsia is to deliver the baby. So obviously it is better to be able to prevent preeclampsia to help ensure that a term pregnancy takes place. Some of the risk factors for this condition include obesity, a family history of type 2 diabetes and or hypertension, depression, anxiety, diets low in fruits and vegetables, and low levels of physical activity. Now, these findings were reported in the American Journal of Hypertension during the month of July 2008, and this study corroborates what has been reported from many other studies. If you're wondering how this translates in terms of increasing fiber intake, this study pointed out that consuming two slices of whole grain bread daily would be the equivalent of adding 5 grams of fiber a day, and just think those two slices of whole grain bread daily could help decrease the risk of preeclampsia if you're pregnant. And finally, I want to point out something related to women's health careers and what NIH is doing. NIH just recently released a request for applications to support research on causal factors and interventions that promote and support the careers of women in biomedical and behavioral science and engineering. This initiative will provide from $2 to $3 million to fund up to 8 R01 awards during fiscal year 2009. Now, I should tell you that this RFA grew out of the NIH Working Group on Women in Biomedical Careers, which is co-chaired by Dr. Ilya Zuhuni, the director of NIH, and myself. And this working group is looking to see what NIH can do to advance careers for women in biomedical careers. And one of the issues that has been raised and has been given a lot of consideration has been what are some of the causal factors that contribute to the career patterns of women in behavioral science, engineering, and biomedical careers, and do we really understand the efficacy of programs designed to eliminate sex gender disparities? This RFA will help us to fund research to evaluate the efficacy of programs that exist and to really understand the effectiveness of those that that do exist. For information, go to the NIH website, nih.gov, nih.gov, and it's right on the front page of that website. And we invite your interest and we invite your grant applications for this initiative. We'll have more updates in the next podcast, and coming up next, I'll visit with Dr. Schmidt for a discussion on women and women's mental health. We'll be right back with more Pinpoint on Women's Health.
If you had the key to unlock the secrets of medical science, you'd use it. At the NIH Clinical Center, many of our studies involve healthy volunteers who provide valuable insights in finding new ways to prevent, diagnose, and treat common and rare disorders.
Do you have the key?
Log on to clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116 for more info. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Welcome back to Pinpoint on Women's Health. Our guest today is Dr. Peter Schmidt, Chief of the Section on Behavioral Endocrinology in the National Institute of Mental Health here at the National Institutes of Health. And Dr. Schmidt is going to discuss with us today depression and why it is important for women and about women. So, Dr. Schmidt, tell us, why is depression an important topic for us to understand related to women's health?
Thanks, Vivian, and thank you for inviting me to talk with you today. Depression's a very important condition for women for several reasons. First, it is about twice as frequent in women compared to men. So a woman over her lifetime has about a 1 in 5 chance, or about approximately 20% risk of developing a depression at some point in her life, whereas in men it would be, say, around 12%. We think that there are probably some biological reasons that may relate or contribute to that difference in the prevalence, but there also may be some social reasons as well, and certainly that's a great source of interest.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you is a question that I am often asked, which is depression really more common in women than it is in men, or are women more apt to seek help, professional help for their depression? I think you may have addressed that, but maybe you can clarify that point because it is a question I often hear.
I'm with you. I think it's a very important point to clarify, and that, in fact, probably both are the case. I think the most important issue is that when people have who have trained to administer and to make the clinical meaningful diagnosis of depression, when they've gone out into the community So away from clinics, that they have continued to identify this twofold or a twice greater risk for depression in women compared to men. Not only when they've gone into the communities in the Western world, but even in some Eastern countries. So that seems to be very, very much present. Now, we also know that in looking at a number of conditions, that many women may present for care more so than in a greater rate than men. But in terms of depression, when I'm talking about a twofold increased risk, that's based on community samples of people.
What are some of the risk factors for depression in women?
Well, there's a number of risk factors. Certainly, a past history of depression is one of the greater risks. So if a woman has had, or a man has had, a previous episode of depression, they're at an increased risk for developing subsequent episodes. In addition, a number of risk factors have been identified, including some social in terms of lower socioeconomic group, geographical issues, urban versus rural inhabitants seem to be at a higher risk. Things like smoking, factors like that, lifestyle factors may increase the risk. Many of them seem to carry an increased risk independent of what may happen when somebody does develop a depression, that, you know, some of these factors may actually be forms of, like, smoking or alcohol use, maybe forms of self-medication, but they seem to convey an increased risk separately as well.
What about genetic predisposition, family history? Do we see depression running in families?
We do. We see basically all forms of depression seems to have some familiarity in that family history does increase the risk. Now, recently, there's been some very interesting work on that in both men and women showing an interaction between, say, a genetic risk that may be present in the family and life events, which is another major risk factor, is early life trauma. So when these two seem to come together at a certain level of severity, both in terms of the genetic risk and the number of life events that somebody has sustained, that there seems to be translate into an increased risk for depression.
Dr. Schmidt, tell us about the impact of depression on women and women's ability to function and women's ability to work and to have normal lives.
We know that recently several studies, one particular out of the World Health Organization, has identified that in developed countries, depression is one of the leading sources of disease-related disability. So when you look beyond mortality in terms of cause of death, and you look at what might just impact or impair someone's function, depression at this time is second only to heart disease as a leading source of disease-related disability in the Western world, and is predicted to become one of the leading sources of disability worldwide once in over the next 20 years, in particular in more developing economies when infectious diseases are treated, then depression should become kind of a greater source of problems. And this impact is twofold. One, depression, as you mentioned, can impact on a person's life and their quality of life on several levels. So it may have an economic burden in terms of preventing them from doing their work, from showing up at work at times. It may have a personal impact where it may impact on relationships, both the ability, say, with a partner to maintain a relationship, or also their ability to parent. Finally, there may be a certain medical morbidity that's a source associated with depression, and that increasingly we see that having an episode of depression increases a person's risk for developing a number of medical illnesses. So, for example, in women, this is particularly important, that an episode of depression may increase the risk for osteoporosis, may increase the risk for the metabolic syndrome. It carries an association of a twofold risk for developing dementia, and may also increase the risk for heart disease. In the latter, in terms of cardiovascular disease, studies from the Women's Health Initiative have shown that in women who have had no prior risk factors for heart disease, that even having a relatively mild depression would increase the risk of dying from a heart attack by about 50% over a period of 5 years. So there's a substantial kind of risk that's particularly relevant to women at midlife.
So that's a very striking statistic, that depression can increase the risk for cardiovascular disease or heart attack. And we know that heart attacks or myocardial infarctions are the leading cause of death for women in this country. So the association of depression and perhaps preventing or alleviating depression becomes even more significant when we think about the health and longevity of women.
Exactly. We used to think that it wouldn't be so unreasonable to think that somebody would get depressed if they had a heart attack or if they had a stroke. But as people started studying these relationships, they found that indeed the depressions often preceded some of these medical events by 6 to 8 years or longer. And so the notion that the depression was occurring after the fact, which it may in some people, and may increase their risk of morbidity or of kind of disease-related or disease severity. But there are also many times when the depression precedes by several years the medical event. And that truly is what people are now starting to focus on, to try to see whether treating the depressions at that point would decrease the risk in these individuals from subsequently developing a medical illness.
Well, let's go back to another condition you mentioned, which is osteoporosis. We have a podcast on osteoporosis in which it was also mentioned that there was a tie between depression and osteoporosis. How do you relate osteoporosis to depression?
Well, good question.
Or do we know?
We truly don't know for sure. There are many candidates, but we do know that having previously had a depression seems to increase the risk of a lower bone density in both men and women. More so, increasingly, we're seeing that some of the treatments for depression may increase the risk for reducing bone density. So, for example, two studies have looked at agents, the selective serotonin reuptake agents. They're also called SSRIs, is their acronym. That since there is the way in which these medications work is that they alter a protein that regulates the amount of serotonin in the synapse. That protein is also on some bone cells. And so their effect in terms of potentially improving mood may also overlap with an effect on bone. Now, the problem is they may be very effective for treating depression, but in some people it seems to increase their risk for developing osteoporosis. So that's why if people are on these medications for a long time, they should touch back or check back with their doctor about whether this is adding to their cumulative risk for osteoporosis down the road.
A very important point to remember. But we've been talking about depression, but I'm sure there are different types of depression. So maybe you can inform our listeners of the different types of depression or how you would classify depression.
Yes. Well, the two most frequent or the two most prevalent forms of depression are described as what's called major depressive episode or a minor depressive episode. And they're basically similar phenomena, they just differ in their severity. So a major depression is defined by a classification schema published by the American Psychiatric Association in a diagnostic manual. And essentially it requires that certain symptoms be present for a persistent period of time. So in that diagnostic classification, symptoms of sadness or loss of interest be present nearly every day, all day, for at least a 2-week period. So in that way, they're looking at trying to establish a persistence of these symptoms in addition to those core symptoms of sadness or loss of enjoyment or interest in their usual activities. There may be a number of other symptoms such as a disturbance in sleep, changes in appetite, feelings of guilt or that the person no longer has value, as well as a number of other vegetative symptoms that may be present. These symptoms also need to be present for that 2-week duration. Where some of these symptoms then are distinguished from, say, just sadness is that these symptoms are also associated with some personal or functional impairment, so that the symptoms of depression are preventing the person from doing their work as they normally would, or the symptoms of depression are preventing the person from interfering with their relationship. So in major depression, there's a criteria of the number of symptoms that are present, which is a proxy for severity. Minor depression, just it's the same symptoms, but fewer are present, but also for a persistent period of 2 weeks. Now, in addition to those traditional symptoms, we're also seeing that many people present, and particularly women, present with somatic symptoms. So this is another difference between men and women in the depression, that many women will present with somatic symptoms. In fact, overall, about 50% of people with depression present with somatic symptoms, but this tends to be more frequent in women than men.
What are somatic symptoms?
Somatic symptoms would be physical symptoms, like actually in addition to the sadness or loss of enjoyment, the person might present with actual musculoskeletal pain. So pain, kind of diffuse pain throughout the body. Or pronounced fatigue, that they're just feeling kind of they're listless, that they do something and they're tired more easily. So those symptoms seem to be present in depression. And rather than causing the depression, similar to what we described in terms of the medical illnesses, that we also now are seeing that they seem to be part of the depression as much as some of the emotional symptoms.
Is there a variation in age for young women versus more mature women in terms of depression or types of depression or experiences with depression?
Well, I think the in general, no. Depression, once a woman is of reproductive age, so we start seeing differences in depression, or we actually see an increase, the increase in depression that occurs around puberty. And at that time, it's when we start observing the sex difference in terms of women being at an increased risk compared to men. So once puberty, or at least around kind of mid-teens, that's the time where we start seeing kind of more depression, and we start seeing these sex differences in the prevalence of depression. There is and then it seems to be fairly stable at that point, the prevalence rates, until after the menopause, and say several years after the menopause, when there seems to be a reduced risk of depression in some women. Now, we're not sure about that, whether there's just, fewer people. It may reflect the difference in longevity between men and women. But there does seem to be somewhat of a decrease in the prevalence risks for both men and women as they get older.
When we have seminars here at NIH, I can say that the seminar topic that has drawn the largest crowds, and I'd like to think we have a lot of popular topics on women's health research, but the topic that has drawn the largest crowds have been those dealing with mood disorders. There is an extremely lot of interest and concern about mood disorders in women. Could you talk about mood disorders a little bit?
Sure. One of the part of what you suggested is that in addition to these sex differences in either the prevalence or in the presentation of depression, there also seem to be periods of time when some women may be at an increased risk for developing depression. And during periods of hormonal transitions, a proportion of women will be at an increased risk of experiencing a disorder in their mood at that time. So, for example, as I'd mentioned, although we don't understand puberty, the physiology of puberty very well, that appears to signal a time when some of these sex differences appear. Other times, such as the postpartum period, for a subgroup of women, they may be at an increased risk for developing depression at this time. Otherwise, the menopause transition and across the menstrual cycle. Now, what's critical is that the majority of women don't seem to be experiencing or at risk for developing a mood disorder or even mood symptoms at these times. But in a subgroup that we're now identifying, that seems to be a period at risk.
And obviously those women have a lot of concerns or have questions about that or wonder if that's what they're experiencing. In talking about times during a woman's lifespan when she may be at greater risk for having depression. There's been a lot in the news and a lot of confusion, I think, related to postpartum depression. Could you say a little bit about postpartum depression and what we really know about it?
Well, it's a very important topic, Vivian, and I think there's been increasingly a focus on the need for more research on this condition, both at a government level as well as scientifically. And our best estimates in terms of the prevalence of postpartum depression would be that a major depression occurs approximately in 7% of births. Minor depressions, I mentioned, a less severe form, but also very important and associated with much disability in its own right, may occur in another 7%. So overall, about 14% of births will be associated with a depression. The depressions that we know may occur, even though we call them postpartum depression, in many women, first evidence of some negative mood symptoms or mood symptoms developing may occur in the last trimester. And so there may actually be somewhat of a misnomer that it may be more around the time of delivery in which we see the onset of depressive symptoms. Now, we can figure this out, the birth rate, if you think of the number of births that are in the country, it works out to be about 500,000 women that are at risk of developing postpartum major or minor depressions. So it's a substantial number of women that are at risk. And it carries an impact on both the ability of the woman to serve as a mother during the very first, very early time with her baby, as well as kind of the relationships with her spouse.
Are there certain things that women should know or consider that might let them know that they might be more at risk of developing postpartum depression? Or are there specific things that those who are providing health care for women who are pregnant should know to look for that might alert them to the possibility of increased risk of developing postpartum depression? And how are we handling it today? And how is it being, other than being able to detect it early, do we have ways to prevent, and how are we treating it?
Okay, it's a long list. First off, the biggest risk factor, as with other forms of depression, the biggest risk factor is having a depression previously during a prior pregnancy. So having one episode of postpartum depression increases the risk 3 to 4-fold of another one. So if a woman has had a depression in the past, then she and her doctor should be that should be right on the radar screen during pregnancy, and they should be watching very carefully during the postpartum period. Now, otherwise, family history seems to also be associated with pregnancy. In fact, postpartum depression seems to be very much run in families. So if a woman knows of her mother or of a sister that may have had an episode of depression, that also should raise a flag. And it doesn't predict with 100% kind of accuracy, but it increases the risk slightly, and it should be on the person's screen for working with their doctor. Otherwise, I think if in the absence of those risk factors, or even in the presence, a woman should, the first thing is to ask the question. If she notices that after a couple of weeks she's feeling out of sorts, say during the latter part of pregnancy or even postpartum, if she's noticing herself tearful. Many of the women that we see in the clinic would describe, feeling kind of tearful, they're starting to worry about the baby's health, worry about their ability to function as a mother. They also may start noticing that instead of kind of getting help from people, they tend to be more isolated. Number of women that we've seen in the clinic, or that my patients say that they'll, stay in bed. They're not able to sleep as well and feel kind of restored, but they're just kind of isolating themselves in their bedroom. So those kind of feelings or behaviors should alert a woman to it's time to talk to her doctor. Certainly the doctors should be asking these kind of questions. With the prevalence rates that we've talked about, that these are not rare conditions, and certainly there are treatments that are effective, both medication that involve medication and non-medication therapies that are effective, and these things should be provided as options to these women.
Let me ask you one other question, which is one that has been discussed a lot as we talk about women in clinical trials and clinical research studies, and that is, what do we now know about treating women for their depression during the time that they are going through pregnancy?
Well, there's a lot of information about using medications during pregnancy to prevent relapses. So this is probably one of the most difficult and complicated questions in clinical medicine, that we know that there may be, that taking a woman off medications during pregnancy may increase her risk for relapse, whereas keeping a woman on medication like an antidepressant or a mood stabilizer may convey an increased risk either for complications around pregnancy or subsequently for the child's development. And certainly, I think the view of many women that I've spoken with, that they would prefer not to be on any medications, just in terms of the child's health and avoiding any possible risk of interfering with the child's normal development. Now, having said that, becoming depressed may be associated with a tremendous amount of dysfunction during pregnancy when an attention for the woman's attention to her own health and her baby's, the developing baby, is critical. So this is a very individual decision. There are risks on both sides. And so one needs to take stock of what could be the consequences of somebody developing a depression. So, for example, depending on the severity of the previous depression, depending on the type of network of support that the woman might have during pregnancy, all these factors need to be taken into account with her. And so really what I do is I sit down with the women who are kind of bringing this to us, and we sort out very much on an individual basis what would be the risks of following one strategy versus another.
Excellent, excellent discussion. I'm sure the women and their healthcare providers who are listening to this podcast will take that message to heart. I don't want to keep you too long, but I have two more areas that I want to briefly touch on. One is an important one since we're at the National Institutes of Health. What can you tell us about some of the research that's going on related to depression in women? And are there some potential breakthroughs or some very exciting news that we've recently learned from research being conducted here, perhaps from your own research?
Well, first, Vivian, there has been, and I think this reflects so well on your efforts in your office, is that there has been a huge increase in the number of women who are participating in trials. Doesn't mean we don't need more to participate, but really, I think throughout the country, there's been a great in a kind of a upsurgence increase in the number of women participating in clinical trials. And this is very important because we are getting information now that we didn't and couldn't get maybe 5 to 10 years ago. In terms of recent studies and recent efforts, I think we're learning a lot more about what the relationship between hormone changes in hormones, reproductive hormones, and the onset of depression in women. So, for example, all of these conditions seem to be associated with a change in the hormone. There's not an actual hormone deficiency that's present. So in women with postpartum depression or in women who develop depression during the menopause transition, it's not that there's an abnormality of estrogen or progesterone that's present. But it seems to be that the changes in the hormones in these women who are otherwise vulnerable will trigger the onset of symptoms, perhaps similar to how, say, a negative life event may trigger depression in some people. So these may be very important cues or biological cues to trigger depression. Now, in that regard, we know that a woman who has severe premenstrual dysphoria, it seems to be a different condition than postpartum depression. So these are not all the same condition. They may affect women, different women. Now, our efforts are to try to understand what the role of these hormones are, both in what's causing the condition, but also what might be an effective treatment. We know that, for example, the response rate to depression, the response to a traditional antidepressant in depression is about 30%. So if we're looking to eliminate depressive symptoms, recent studies supported by NIMH have shown that we would be seeing about a 30% remission rate. A little higher number will actually respond to a traditional antidepressants. So there's a need for finding alternative therapies. And as well, many people would like to find an alternative therapy, given that some of these medications also may increase the risk for a number of other medical conditions. So hormonal therapies is one area. And so, for example, we have a study where we're looking at the effects of estradiol in depression during the postpartum period. We have seen some fairly rapid response to this treatment, and it may be that it provides a very quick response that will allow the woman to become kind of have a relief of her depression. And then once her menstrual cycle starts up again after nursing or just after delivery, that may be, she may be then good to go in terms of kind of producing her own estrogen. But it may be that this provides a critical bridge that would allow her to have an elimination of her symptoms. Similarly, in women who experience depression during the menopause transition, we've shown in past studies, and that's been replicated in other centers, that estradiol short-term has an antidepressant-like effect. We're now looking at other alternatives to estradiol, given the results of the Women's Health Initiative raising questions about the long-term safety of estrogen. We're now looking at a number of compounds called selective estrogen receptor modulators that may act like estrogen in some tissues, but not like estrogen in other tissues. So we perhaps have a different safety profile in these people. And so the idea of developing alternative therapies in some of these mood disorders where they're linked to a hormone transition may arm us with some new therapies for women as well.
I want to congratulate you for your research and the efforts that you put forth, and that's why we're very excited to have you with us today talking about women in depression, and really impressed with the work that you and your lab have been doing and how you sort of set the stage for many investigators across the country to be in furthering research in the similar areas. I have one last area which is a little bit different. And that is, as we talk about women in depression, it sort of fits with sort of mental health in general. What are some of the current efforts that you can cite for us to help us overcome some of the societal factors which too often have women feeling that there is a stigma to having depression, just as they may feel there's a stigma to having some mental illness instead of understanding it is a medical illness, so that women don't fear seeking help when they need it for depression or other forms of mental health?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really very important point. And I think there was a study that was actually conducted by the NIMH that looked at what proportion of men and women get adequate treatment in the United States. And so adequate treatment was defined by a physician prescribing a medication and seeing the person for a number of visits, or just going and seeing a kind of a health care provider and sitting with them for, say, 20 or 30 minutes on three or four occasions. So pretty, you know, kind of modest requirements. But even with that, 80% of the depressed people who were studied in this country didn't get even adequate care. So there is a great kind of stigma about depression in particular, and many forms of behavioral health or mental illness. Most people, after they have a depression, for example, don't present for treatment for 6 to 8 years after that first episode. And given the sequelae that we talked about, both in terms of emotional, social, as well as even now medical issues, that this is a real, real problem. So I think, first off, people need to, we need to get the word out. And so programs like this, people need to be educated about what both depression is, that there are effective treatments for it, that this isn't something that reflects on people's character or their constitution. Depressions are very likely biological events and that are also transferred from family, one family member to another. So these are medical conditions. They take a very devastating toll and can be treated very effectively.
Well, I think you've sort of given our closing statement, but I'm going to ask you anyway. I've asked you a number of questions. I don't know if I've missed inquiring about an important area related to women and depression, so I want to give you a chance to have the final word in this podcast about women and depression.
I think we've covered many things, and I'd like to thank you for inviting me to speak with you, you know, for this podcast. I think my main comment is that women would probably be their best treatment or their best advocates in the healthcare system, and that if they're concerned that they're having symptoms of sadness or loss of enjoyment and that these symptoms are persisting and causing them some trouble, that at that point they should go and talk to somebody about whether some treatment would be indicated.
Thank you so much, Dr. Schmidt, for what was an extremely informative discussion. And thank you also for the work that you're doing in research that will help advance women's health, and especially women's health as it relates to their mental health and preserving our minds and our ability to function. So coming up next, a few final thoughts for this month when Pinpoint on Women's Health continues.
The National Institutes of Health invites adults age 18 through 75 to participate in a clinical study for asthma. All study-related tests are provided at no cost. Participants are compensated. Call 1-866-999-1116. That's 1-866-999-1116 for information. Or visit www.clinicaltrials.gov. The NIH is a nonprofit government agency in part of the Department of Health and Human Services.
You've heard a wonderful discussion about what we know about depression, major depression, minor depression, when it occurs, how it affects women, the fact that it is more common in women than it is in men, but it can affect both the males and females in your families, that we tend to see it more often after puberty in women, that we learn that there are somatic symptoms that may be associated with depression, that we see depression not only related to perhaps the menstrual cycle in women, perhaps showing the relationship to hormonal transitions, but also discussed and learned quite a bit, I think, about postpartum depression as well as depression associated with the menopause transition. And for that, I'm very grateful to Dr. Peter Schmidt from the National Institute of Mental Health for all the information he has given us, and perhaps most of all, the fact that he has pointed out what we know, what we're learning, what we have learned, and that he himself, like many others, are conducting research now to help us better understand issues, the biology, the results of, and how to better diagnose and treat and prevent depression in women as well as men, and to understand how depression may differ from or be similar to that we see in men. So with what he has presented to you, I can refer you to, for more information, you can go to the NIH website and just enter into the search vehicle depression, and it will take you to the National Institute of Mental Health, where you can then get more information or follow-up information to the discussion that you have heard today. In a moment, the announcer will tell you where to send your comments and suggestions for future episodes. I'd like to thank you for joining us on this episode of Pinpoint on Women's Health. I'm Dr. Vivian Pinn, Director of the Office of Research on Women's Health at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. Thank you for joining us.
You can email your comments and suggestions concerning this podcast to Marshall Love at lovem@od.nih.gov. Pinpoint on Women's Health comes from the Office of Research on Women's Health and is a production of the NIH Radio News Service, News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison at the Office of the Director, National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.